Hi everyone, I'm Abhishek Rajamwale from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I'm here to present our work done on block management in solid-state devices. This is joint work with Vijayan Prabhakaran and John D. Davis of Microsoft Research. The storage stack, as we know now, has remained static for a long time. This is mainly due to the fact that mechanical disk drives have existed for decades. The narrow block-level storage interface has also existed for years. And there's not much information flow between the software and the storage device, except for block reads and writes. Due to this, the file systems and other pieces of software make a lot of assumptions about the underlying storage device. For example, the file systems assume that sequential accesses are much faster than random accesses, or that there is little or no background activity going on in the device. While all these assumptions have held true for disks, what if the underlying device changes? SSDs are a completely different kind of device from disks. Apart from the obvious difference that there are no mechanical or moving parts in SSDs, there are also subtle differences. Like an SSD is composed of multiple flash packages. These flash packages are interconnected in a variety of different ways which define the internal architecture of the SSD. Further, these devices have complex internal operations going on continuously in the background. Apart from the fact that SSDs are different from disks, it's also important to note that SSDs differ amongst themselves. The range of SSDs available can be broadly categorized into low-end, medium-range, and high-end devices based on characteristics like firmware complexity, interconnections, logical-to-physical mapping, and whether striping or ganging exists in these devices. Since SSDs are different from disks and also different amongst themselves, the obvious question that comes to mind is, whether the existing file system assumptions still hold true. And what we find is that several of these assumptions are no longer valid with the use of SSDs. For example, in SSDs, random accesses are much faster and may be comparable to sequential accesses, unlike disks. Write amplification may happen in SSDs, which is not the case with disks. Next, SSDs have significant background activity for cleaning and wear leveling operations, which is not present in disks. Also, the SSD flash media wears down significantly, unlike the disk media. And lastly, SSDs may have completely dynamic logical to physical mapping, due to which there's no principle of locality between logical blocks in SSDs. Now, the question is, as a result of these broken assumptions, is there a need to modify the storage stack for SSDs? In our work, we perform case studies for each of these violated assumptions and find that we need modifications to tune the storage stack for SSDs. In order to achieve these modifications, we need a richer interface to convey more information to the device. For example, information about I/O priorities and free blocks, as we'll see later. And we also need to put more functionality in the device to handle the low-level block management tasks. One possible solution could be to use an existing interface called the object-based storage. Here's the outline for the rest of my talk. First, I'm going to briefly present the results of our benchmarking of various SSDs. Then I'm going to present three case studies to propose modifications to the storage stack. Then I'm going to discuss how object-based storage may be a good fit for SSDs. Then I'll talk about related work and finally conclude. For benchmarking, we used a range of SSD samples, all of which were engineering samples and pre-production samples obtained from different companies by Microsoft. We used both single-level cell and multi-level cell-based SSDs. And in our results, we anonymized these SSDs as S1, S2, and so on. For benchmarking, we performed read and write experiments on a 7200 RPM Seagate Barracuda disk drive and on the SSD samples that we had. Some of the results of benchmarking are shown here. The table shows the sequential and random read and write bandwidth for the hard disk drive and the range of SSD samples that we had. The interesting thing to note here is the ratio of sequential to random access bandwidths. We can see that the ratio of sequential to random reads is pretty high in the hard disk drive, but low for all the SSDs, which obviously means that random reads are much less problematic in SSDs. More interesting are the results for writes. We can see that while there are some SSDs whose random write performance is much worse than that of the hard disk drive. However, there are still devices in which the performance of random writes is fast approaching the performance of sequential writes. For example, S1 and S4 shown here. This is achieved by using log structuring techniques inside the flash translation layer of the device. Next, I'm going to present case studies for addressing three of the violated assumptions and propose modifications to the storage stack. For our case studies, we used measurements on real SSDs wherever possible and used file system traces from real machines for our experiments. To evaluate our proposals, we used the DiskSim simulator from Parallel Data Labs at CMU and made changes to the SSD module extension written for DiskSim by people at Microsoft Research. The first case study is about write amplification. Write amplification happens in low-end and medium-range devices, and the reasons could be that the write size is less than the stripe size of the device, or that the physical page size is less than the logical page size of the device. Let's see what happens in write amplification. Assume that the SSD consists of four flash packages, and the writes are striped across these packages. Now, when the file system issues a write whose size is less than the stripe size of the device, then what happens is that the entire stripe has to be read out, the required contents modified, and the whole stripe is written back into the device. To see whether such write amplification happens in a real device, we took measurements on the SSD samples that we had. In our experiment, we issued continuous writes of varying sizes. The results of our experiments for one of the SSD samples labeled S2 are shown here. On the x-axis, we vary the write size in megabytes, and on the y-axis, we report the throughput obtained in megabytes per second. We can clearly see here that we obtain peak bandwidth when the write size is a multiple of a megabyte. From this, we infer that there is striping going on in the device and the stripe size is 1 megabyte. It is very important to note here that such phenomenon was not observed for some of the other samples that we had, like S1 and S4. From this, we infer that write amplification happens on mostly low-end and medium-range devices. We believe that these devices either have a fixed logical-to-physical mapping or have a small mapping table due to which write amplification happens. In order to cope with the problem of write amplification, we tried to merge requests along the stripe boundary in the device. For our case study, we implemented this logic in the simulator SSD module and then ran traces on this modified simulator. The results of our experiments are shown here. This figure shows the results of running synthetic traces. On the x-axis, we vary the probability of sequential accesses in the request. And on the y-axis, we report the response time, which is normalized to the response time with completely random requests. So in general, the lower the bars from the value of 1, the better is the response time of the system. We can see that as the probability of sequential accesses is increased along the x-axis, the device is able to merge more requests along the stripe boundary, and we get improvement in the response time, going up to as much as 50%. We also tried running some real benchmark traces, and the results are shown here. We can see that the IOZone benchmark shows the most improvement here, about 36%, because of the sequential nature of the benchmark, while the other benchmarks also show some improvement. The next case study is about background activity going on in the device. SSDs violate the assumption that storage devices are passive with little background activity. In fact, SSDs have significant background activity for cleaning and wear leveling operations. The problem here is that the hosts have no control about when the background activity starts in the device. So if the system has notion of I/O priorities, then what we must do is to prevent the effect of background operations on these priority traffic. Our approach here is to implement priority-aware cleaning, in which we inform the device about I/O priorities and let the device avoid background operations when there are critical I/O in flight. For this case study, we again use the DiskSim simulator with its support for priority request queuing. We also use a synthetic trace generator and modified the simulator SSD module. For implementing priority-aware cleaning, we use two cleaning thresholds, low and critical. In general, the device starts cleaning when the number of free blocks falls below the low threshold. However, if there are outstanding priority requests, then the device would start cleaning only if the number of free blocks in the device falls below the critical threshold. Now let us try to understand the results of priority-aware cleaning in steps. The initial figure here shows the results for priority-unaware cleaning. On the x-axis, we vary the write percentage in requests, and on the y-axis, we report the response time in milliseconds. So in general, the lower the data points, the better is the response time. The solid line shows the response time for priority requests and the dotted line for non-priority requests. We can see here that the response time of priority requests is much better. This is because of using priority request queuing in the I/O scheduling software. Now let's see what happens if the device also understands priorities and implements priority-aware cleaning. The results are shown by the blue lines here. As the solid blue line suggests, the response time of priority requests is further improved because the device tries to avoid cleaning during these operations, during these priority requests. And not surprisingly, the result for non-priority requests gets much worse. In terms of percentage, we see an average improvement of about 10% in the response time of priority requests. Last case study is about device wear down. SSDs violate the assumption that the storage device media does not wear down significantly. In fact, we know that blocks in SSDs have finite erase cycles, about 100,000 for single-level cell memory. The problem here is that we must try to reduce the number of writes to blocks as much as possible in order to increase the lifetime of the device. Our approach here is to implement informed cleaning. We know that the file system has information about free blocks, but the device does not. If we convey this information about free blocks to the device, then the device can avoid copying free blocks during reclamation in the cleaning operation. Let's try to understand informed cleaning by using a trivial example. We can see here that the file system has information about which blocks are in use and which blocks are free. Assume that at the beginning, block 1 is in use. After some time, the file system writes to blocks 2 to 8, leaving only block number 9 free. Assume that at this point, the file system frees up blocks 2, 4, 6, and 8. Now, only the file system has the knowledge of which blocks are free, but the device does not. If the SSD engages into cleaning operation at this point, it will try to copy all the blocks from 1 to 8 to reclaim them during the cleaning operation. With informed cleaning, however, the device can avoid copying the blocks 2, 4, 6, and 8 because they don't contain any relevant information. For our case study on informed cleaning, we used postmark benchmark traces from real machine, along with free block information gathered with the help of a pseudo driver. For implementing informed cleaning, we modified the simulator SSD module to keep track of the freed blocks and skipped copying the free blocks for reclamation during the cleaning operation. The results of our experiments are shown in the figure here. On the x-axis, we vary the number of transactions in the postmark benchmark. And on the y-axis, we report the number of pages moved in thousands during the cleaning operation. So in general, the lower the bars, the lesser is the number of pages moved, and the better is the cleaning efficiency. The blue bars indicate the number of pages moved during the cleaning operation without free block information. And the orange bars indicate the number of pages moved with informed cleaning. We can see that as the number of transactions are increased along the x-axis, the device has to do more and more cleaning. However, in all the cases, only about a one-third of the pages needed to be moved with informed cleaning. This translates into an improvement by a factor of 3 in cleaning efficiency, and the device lifetime is also improved proportionately. Another important effect is that the cleaning time is also reduced by about 30 to 40%, thus improving the response time of the system as well. Here's a quick summary of the improvements that we saw in the case studies. We must remember that to cope with write amplification, we needed the information of stripe size from the device. For priority-aware cleaning, we needed the information of I/O priorities from the operating system. And for informed cleaning, we needed the information about free blocks from the file system. In summary, we need a richer interface to be able to pass such information between the software and the storage device. Let's see what a possible solution could be. We know that only the SSD has the intricate knowledge of its internals. For example, the amount of parallelism that exists in the device, whether gangs of flash packages operate in synchrony, or whether multiple packages share a common data bus or a common control bus. Only the SSD has the exact knowledge of what the logical to physical mapping is, whether superpaging exists in the device to save space for mapping table, or whether striping exists in the device. Further, only the SSD has the knowledge of its internal background operations, about when cleaning and wear leveling start, or about whether there's a separate unit for cleaning. So the solution would be to use a richer interface to convey the higher level semantics of operations to the device and let the device handle low level block management tasks. Let's see if using SSD as an object-based storage device can answer our problems. Since OSD manages space for objects, we can implement informed cleaning. If striping exists in the device, then the device can have stripe aligned accesses because it knows the exact stripe size. Further, since the OSD has object attributes, we can implement clever wear leveling techniques by using cold data information on objects, for example, from read-only attributes on objects. We can also use the priority information on objects to implement a priority aware cleaning. So we see that by using SSD as an object-based storage device, we can get best performance out of it, and by letting the OSD handle the low-level block management tasks. There has been a lot of related work on all these topics. Researchers have tried to analyze the design trade-offs in software for using solid-state devices, and there have been similar studies on MEMS-based storage devices. There's also been a lot of work on bridging the storage information gap in storage stack, and there have also been proposals for newer interface like the NVMe HCI. In conclusion, we revisited the storage-specific assumptions for solid-state devices and found that several of these assumptions are no longer valid. To address these broken assumptions, we proposed improvements to tune the storage stack for SSDs. To achieve these modifications, we need a richer interface to convey more information to the device, and also need to put more functionality in the devices. One possible solution could be to use the object-based storage. By using SSD as an object-based storage device, we can get the best performance and also increase the lifetime of the device by letting the OSD handle the low-level task of block management in solid-state devices. Thank you for listening. And I invite you to ask questions.
Irfan Ahmed, VMware. So the only information going in the examples that you gave between the SSD up to the operating system is sort of a static kind of a initialization time type of information, like track size. Yeah. And all the other information was going down. Can you shed some light on examples where it might be interesting for dynamic information to flow between the SSD up towards the operating system? Have you come across such? Have you studied that area?
I could give an example. Like it does not exist now, but with the use of SLC and MLC-based cells in the same SSD, the blocks actually would be, the placing of the blocks would be dynamic, because you would want that you would place the information that you need faster in the SLC-based cells, and you would want the lesser important data to be kept in the MLC-based cells. So this information about what the logical physical mapping would be for such devices is sort of really dynamic, and such information would be probably be useful to be shared dynamically. Does that answer?
David Lang, don't most of the same issues, except for the wear out, also apply to disk RAID arrays, especially if you've got external arrays with their own cache and controllers?
Could you repeat the question? I'm sorry for that.
Okay. Don't most of the issues that you described there, write amplification and so on, Also seem to apply to RAID 5, RAID 6 arrays as well.
Yes, but the write amplification thing is definitely applied to RAID arrays. But the as far as the background activity is concerned, the background activities...
Rebuilding or scanning the array, they do it as well.
Yes, but this on SSDs, it's like continuous. You can never prevent it. If SSD uses log structuring, it is just continuous. And sometimes the device spends as much as like 11% on cleaning operations. I think I have a slide on that. Maybe I'll just show quickly. So, this one. Yeah, but... So in the same experiment that we did, we saw that the cleaning time was as much as 11% of the time. So it's just continuous, and the same goes for wear leveling operations. So RAID arrays typically have this scrubbing and these activities, but most likely they can be sort of scheduled.
Let's take one more question.
All right. So in the face of having a lot of legacy, and we've managed to keep the block device interface stable for I don't know how many decades. And at the same time, the problem, what I see with object-based interface is that you add some higher level interface, so you would use, I don't know, objects as files or something, but that prevents the file system then to be more elaborate. So do you think might also be an opportunity to communicate the properties of the devices, be it SSD or be it RAID arrays or be it, I don't know, network attached storage, back to the operating system and let the operating system deal with all the decisions with its powerful CPU instead of pushing more functionality and decisions into the devices?
I think there are certainly two ways to go about it. One would be the thing that you're saying is to convey all the information and let the operating system and file system handle it. And this is the other approach. And our take on this is that as the devices grow more complex and more and have more functionality, it makes more sense to have them handle more of these tasks, the lower level block management sort of task, and let the file system do less work. I mean, that's our take on it. Well, what you said is also correct. That's one way to handle it.
Okay, let's thank the speaker.
Thank you.
Great. Okay, so my name is Philip, and I'm a PhD student at Stanford, and this is joint work I've done with my advisor, Dawson Engler. So static analysis is an automated way of finding bugs in software by inspecting source code without actually executing it. And static analysis has been a fairly active area of research for the past few decades, and in recent years has been commercialized to various products and deployed in industry. So the topic of this talk is how do developers respond to bug reports issued by these static analysis tools. So this research will address three main questions, which I'll talk about in order. First, which bug reports reported by these tools do developers actually look at? Right? So static analysis tools have no troubles generating hundreds or thousands of warnings, but developers, because they have limited time and attention, can't possibly look at all of them. So which ones do they actually triage? And by triage, I mean actually looking at a bug report carefully and determining whether, yes, this is a true bug that we want to deal with, or no, this is a false positive, because either this can never happen in real execution, or there's some imprecision of the tool that the tool made a mistake. So secondly, how are these triage reports clustered? So do developers randomly look at reports in different files, or are they looking at them in clumps? So can we predict which reports someone's going to look at by looking at the other reports they inspect? And lastly, you know, are static analysis bugs actually meaningful? Are they simply merely very superficial things like, oh, you forgot a null pointer check here, or just, you know, simple compiler type warnings that are problems but may not be very deep? Or do they actually indicate something about the quality of the code and some other sorts of bugs that are perhaps deeper? So the way we perform this case study is mostly using quantitative data analysis, and we supplement with some qualitative analysis as well. So our primary data source is 2,125 bug reports reported in the Linux kernel from a static analysis tool from a company called Coverity. And what Coverity did is that they scanned, they've done approximately weekly scans through the Linux kernel source code starting in February 2006 and reported their results in an online database. So developers can look in that database and triage bugs. So they can look at a bug report and say, yes, this is a real bug, or no, this is a false positive. And we also wanted to know the history of these files that the bugs affected. So we mined the source code revision history data from BitKeeper and JIT over the past few years as well. And in order to get lend some insights into to see how to interpret these quantitative results, we emailed this informal questionnaire to kernel developers and received a few responses regarding how they interpreted what we found. So the first topic I want to talk about is which bug reports the developers actually look at. So the main factor that determines whether a developer looks at a bug is what kind of checker is it? What kind of bug is this tool looking for? So the Coverity checker checks for a dozen types of generic low-level C code bugs. So the typical things are buffer overruns or null pointer dereferences and so forth. So this table, what I'm going to show is the number of reports total, the percent of those reports that were actually triaged by developers, and also a relative notion of the false positive rate. So due to confidentiality reasons, we couldn't disclose the actual rates, but we'll just report the relative ones. So I've sorted these reports by the percentage that were actually triaged. So the ones on top are, unsurprisingly, some of the most critical bugs. So buffer overruns are classic sites for security vulnerabilities. Uninitialized valid reads kind of lead to these weird non-deterministic bugs, which may be kind of hard to catch in practice. And also dead code bugs are quite interesting because while they may seem superficially kind of shallow, they actually oftentimes indicate some kind of deep semantic logical misunderstanding. Because if a developer is writing code within a bunch of, let's say, deeply nested conditionals and such, and that code is provably can never execute, then that means that developer has misunderstood something about the interface of the code. And that could actually lead to some weird semantic errors. So on the low end of the triage rates are the types of checkers with really high false positives. So these ones are quite unreliable, that 10, 11, 12, the higher the number of false positives relatively. And so, I mean, it also makes perfect sense because if a checker is unreliable and flaky and issues a lot of false reports, developers are not going to trust it and not going to, be likely to triage their reports. So another thing that correlated with whether reports were triaged is how old the files were. In this graph here, the thing to focus on in the beginning is what's in that shaded box. So we split up files based on their age, based on a cutoff of, let's say, 2 years. So we said every file that's older than 2 years is marked by the plus, and every file that's younger than 2 years by minus. So the 54% on the bottom shows that 54% of bugs in files that are old were triaged versus 71 in files that were young. So because 2 years is kind of an arbitrary scale, we ran the same analysis on different splits. And consistently, the pluses are below the minuses, which means that reports in older files are less likely to be triaged than ones in younger files. So one developer responded in the following way, quote, "More often, the people involved in creating those younger files will still be active kernel developers and still interested in the areas those files cover." So in general, younger files are under more active development than older files, because there are a lot of places in the kernel code base, one person wrote a driver somewhere 10 years ago and didn't really maintain it, so that if a bug report is reported from one of those files, nobody really has the motivation or the expertise to actually look at it. And finally, similarly, reports in smaller files are more likely to be triaged. Again, we did the same split. So let's say 2,000 lines. Anything above 2,000 lines is a big file, and less than 2,000 lines is a small file. And again, big files have a lower chance of their bugs being triaged than smaller files. And the split is fairly consistent, although the effect isn't as strong. And the grayed out marks on the left-hand side are ones that are not statistically significant. And one developer responded with two possible reasons. Quote, perhaps due to the buried and warning syndrome, and also perhaps because smaller files are easier to modify. So smaller files just have less chance of things going wrong. There are probably less reports for smaller files than for bigger files, so they're easier for someone to triage. And also, smaller files are implement usually simpler functionality and are also easier to modify in order to fix bugs in them. So next, I want to look at the clustering behavior. So do developers randomly pick which bugs to look at, or is there some pattern in how they actually inspect these bug reports? So first, there's a clustering in space. So there's a tendency so during a particular scan, let's say, during a particular week, a bunch of files were scanned, and a particular file had, say, 5 bug reports from a static analysis tool. Most likely, if someone actually cares about that file, they'll invest effort into triaging most or all of the reports in that file and say, this is a bug, this is a bug, this is not a bug, so forth. So it's given, we quantified it by giving the numbers above. So the unconditional probability is at 46% of all reports in a given session for a file being triaged. And if the conditional probability, if at least one report was triaged, that jumps up to 65%. So if at least one report is triaged, the probability that all of them are triaged jumps up. And if at least 2 reports are triaged, that jumps up even farther. And the same pattern repeats with untriage. So if someone is ignoring reports for a particular file, they might ignore all the reports, as shown by the similar numbers below. So secondly, there's this clustering time. So you would imagine that if somebody cares enough about a file to inspect and triage bug reports in it, then they'll be more likely to triage future reports in the same file. So recall that the scans are done roughly weekly. So given a scan in week N, and what happened to the bug reports there, can we predict what happens to the bug reports in week N plus 1? So we took all the files with reports in more than one occurring in more than one scan and just calculate conditional probabilities again. So we said, if no bug reports were triaged in some particular scan where there are reports, then the probability that you would triage some reports in the next scan is 50%. And if at least one report was triaged, that conditional probability goes up 9% to 59%. And a developer responded, quote, triaging bug reports can be quite intimidating. Once a developer has got up some confidence in the subsystem, they're more likely to step up to the plate and triage again. So this again shows not only interest, but also expertise. So not only, perhaps one developer may feel comfortable triaging one file and keep on doing it in the future, but also because somebody cares about that file, that means that other developers might care about it as well. And the probabilities go up when someone actually triages it and marks it as a true bug. So not only triaging a report, but saying this is a real bug that we're going to deal with. And that's a stronger, even stronger indicator that somebody cares about this file or this file is important. And again, if the thing was marked as a true bug, and also someone marked in the database, I fixed this now and it's been fixed, then it's even a stronger indicator. So what this shows is that the triaging behavior of developers and files can actually be some kind of proxy for how important this file is. And given this large software system with hundreds or thousands of files, obviously not all files are going to be important to developers at a given time. And and seeing what bugs they triage could be a good proxy for code importance. So then there's the issue of false positives. So if developers mark bugs as false positives, then they're less likely to triage in the future. And the quote here is, quote, false positives tend to lower the maintainer's trust of the tool and are more likely then to let future reports from the same tool slip. So note again that having false positives gives you a slightly higher triage rate than if nobody was triaged, because at least somebody bothered to look at the file, which means someone at least cares about it, but it's lower than all the other probabilities. So that if you triage something marked as false positive, you're a bit less likely to triage the same bugs in the same file in the future. So the final topic I want to discuss is, are these bugs actually meaningful? Are these just simple compiler-like warnings of, oh, this is a silly mistake, I'll fix it? Or do they actually indicate something deeper about code quality? So I want to start by contrasting bugs found by static analysis tools and bugs that are reported by users. So an example of a static analysis bug would be null pointer dereference on line 36 of sounddriver.c. So it's a particular low-level type bug that's has to be apparent in the source code, because otherwise an automatic tool can't find it. And also, it points to an exact line on an exact file. So we don't know what the root cause of this null pointer dereference is. Maybe this is some simple mistake, or maybe the developer actually didn't understand something about what function returned this, the function, the caller can return null. In contrast, a user-reported bug is something at a much higher level. So a user-reported bug might be Sound Blaster card emits a weird tone when playing demo.wave. So the user or the tester usually has no idea which file or line is causing this bug. Perhaps it's several files and lots of lines that are causing this bug. They can only report the symptoms and not the exact cause. So at first glance, these two types of bugs seem really different. Although these are both, incorrect behavior in the program, it seems like developers might care more about user-reported bugs because, for one, they are reported by users. So that means that somebody has actually executed this code, this driver, let's say, and found something that is incorrect. Whereas, because static analysis bugs, because you're not actually executing the program, perhaps this null pointer to reference is only in some weird error handling code when you're about to go out of memory anyways. And yes, it should be patched up, but is it really worth the cost of doing so? So it turns out that static analysis bugs and user-reported bugs are pretty well correlated, actually. So we're claiming that static analysis bug reports can actually predict the incidence of user-reported bugs in the future. And I could direct you to related work that they've done at Microsoft that shows a similar thing on a commercial code base. So what we've done is, to quantify these numbers, what we've done is we only counted all the files alive during February 24, 2006, which is when the first Coverity scan occurred. And that first scan found 981 bug reports. And we did this, we froze this point in time so we could eliminate some biases from calculations. So what we did is we partitioned the file population into those with no reports, into those files with greater than or equal to one report, with some triage reports, and at least two reports. So what we want to do across time is we want to see how many user-reported bugs happen in the near future. You know, right after this, this set of reports happen, what happened a month in the future, 3 months, 6 months, a year, and the rest of the lifetime of the file. So the first thing we want to look at is how many percent of those files in each population actually have user-reported bugs. And notice how I say fixes for user-reported bugs rather than user-reported bugs. So we have to use bug fixes as a proxy. It's the best thing we can do because users or QA or testers can't report bugs to the file granularity usually. But when someone cares enough to fix a bug in an offending file, we can pick that off from the revision history. So we can grep and we can, with pretty high accuracy, know which patches are actually bug fixes. So let's start with 1 month. So files with no static analysis bug reports had about 4% of them had a user-reported bug in the next month, in the following month. And that jumps up about 3x to 13% for files with at least one report. And then it jumps up still higher with a report that's triaged and with a with at least two reports. So going down the column, this means that if you actually have a bug report reported by the static analysis tool, you're a bit more likely to have reports in the future, user-reported bugs in the future. And the similar trends happen across time. You don't have to worry about the numbers, just that down each column, all the numbers monotonically increase. And we did a similar thing with the number of user-reported bugs. So not only how many percent of these files had them, how many on average were there in each file. So again, this same 3x trend kind of persists as you go down each column. And I'll give you the full numbers here. So the important thing is down each column, all the numbers always increase. So we could speculate as to why this might be happening. So one conjecture that some developers have backed up is that although the static analysis tools find these very seemingly superficial type errors of, you're not checking for a null return value, you're going out of bounds in this array, they could actually be indications that developers are misunderstanding something about the interface that they're dealing with. So for example, if you're writing a device driver and you have to deal with the rest of the kernel interfaces, perhaps, if you're not an experienced driver developer, you don't really know that, this function can return a negative value or something. And if you're not as familiar with the interfaces you're using, you may be more likely to misuse them and flag these kind of superficial type warnings. And we argue that code that has more of these superficial type warnings are more likely to actually have deeper functionality errors that users will later report. So which suggests that one use for these static analysis tools, besides finding bugs that you can patch up easily, is to actually be using them as an indicator of code quality. So one developer in a mailing list discussion, actually, in the Linux kernel mailing list, talking about the use of static analysis tools, had the following quote, which I'll read now. Quote, Coverity and similar tools are a true opportunity for us to find out and study suspect parts of our code. Please do not misuse these tools. The goal is not to make the tools happy next time you run them, but to actually fix the problems once and for all. If you focus too much on fixing the problems quickly rather than fixing them cleanly, then we forever lose the opportunity to clean our code because the problems will then be hidden. So this developer is responding to the fact that a lot of times when these static analysis bug reports come in, they are fixed really quickly with the small patch. I mean, you can imagine all these classes of superficial errors can be fixed fairly easily. You have a null pointer reference, you do a check, you have other things. Very quick one-liners can fix them. But what this developer is concerned with is that they might actually be indicators of deeper type of problems with the code that might involve more involved changes or even refactorings, and to not just do these quick superficial patches. So in closing, I'd like to make some suggestions for how we could make these tools more effective in practice. So number one, we could rank and filter bug reports by how likely they are to be triaged. So this is, you know, a similar recall precision problem like Google faces. You know, it doesn't matter if you produce 10,000 bug reports. It only matters that the first three the developer sees are really good and accurate and have low false positive and are the ones that the developer actually cares about. Otherwise, no one's going to bother looking through the rest of 900-something bug reports. Secondly, on a related note, you could, by knowing what code developers actually care about triaging bugs in, you could bias your static analysis. So analysis tools face this trade-off between precision and runtime. So deeper analysis can result in finding better bugs and having lower false positives, but they also take a lot longer time to run. So you could imagine, because you can figure out what code is more important to developers based on what they triage, you can imagine running a deeper analysis on those parts of the code base and doing superficial stuff on other parts of the code base. And number three, as a developer pointed out on the previous slide, is to use these tools as kind of like a dowsing rod, to direct the attention to kind of more shady or problematic code that are more likely to contain other sorts of bugs. And also, lastly, to encourage users of these tools to try to look carefully for the root causes rather than just making quick patches. So if anybody here has experiences using static analysis tools in industry or would like to discuss any of these topics in detail, I'd be happy to talk afterwards. And this time, I'd like to take questions.
I have one question. So with static analysis tools like Coverity, do you find that Linux tends to produce less and less bugs, or it's just stay the same level?
So the question is, for Linux, are there less and less bugs over time, or are they the same level? That's a hard question to answer because there's a lot of other variables involved. Because the code is growing, so perhaps you're thinking about less bugs per 1,000 lines or something. It's other people have looked into that, but I have not looked into that in detail with my data.
Okay.
Anton Burtz of University of Utah. So don't you think that the way to find deeper bugs in code are like some interface inconsistencies is not to run static analysis tools, but instead come up with some metrics of complexity of the code or something else.
So your question is, perhaps code complexity metrics are a better indicator of the shady code than
maybe in a lot of other cases, instead of like dereferencing null pointer, maybe you can do something.
I think the code complexity metrics will work as well, and I think oftentimes I haven't run the study, but I'm sure the weirder types of, let's say, dead code bugs happen because that code is really complex. Maybe they're really deeply nested and there's a lot of indirect function calls or something. So I think those two are complementary.
Yeah, thank you.
So I have a methodology question. You had that the table of probability of everything being taken care of given that one thing had been taken care of. I think it was the a previous slide here.
This one.
Yes. Yeah. And did you control for, in other words, is this in cases where there actually was another bug to be done? Because if there was only one bug, then obviously the probability that if one report is triaged, all of them are triaged is 100%.
Yes, that's a good question. Actually, I didn't put on the bottom is that we only consider sessions with more than one report. And we also have another graph in the paper that addresses that in more detail.
Okay.
Thanks.
Wenji from Fermilab. When just you give that lecture, I just think about it. Have you give this talk, the paper, give the feedback from the people like the Andrew Morton or some key Linux developer for how useful the static analysis
Yeah, I mean, all these quotes are from developers. We have some veteran developers. They asked to be anonymous for the purposes of the paper, but definitely some of these quotes came from some veteran developers.
Okay, thank you.
Not Andrew Morton, though, particularly.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, let's thank the speaker.